You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 442. All good ideas start out as bad ideas. That's why it takes so long. Steven Spielberg.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, today on the show, guys, we have a really inspiring and unique filmmaking story. Today's guests are Xander and Elliot Weaver, the mastermind independent filmmakers behind the feature film Cosmos. Now, on a daily basis, I get pitched just tons and tons of filmmakers wanting to get on the show. And as much as I want to help everybody out, I gotta make sure that the stories that I put on the show are really good and really inspiring to the tribe. And I heard about Xander and Elliot's film Cosmos just by running around the internet. And what made their film so unique is that they shot their feature film just like I did, on a Blackmagic pocket camera, 1080p. And that alone is not enough for it to really grab people's attention because, like I've said before, no one cares about what you shoot it on as long as it's a good story. And these guys were able to shoot a sci-fi adventure film a la Spielberg Zemeckis style about three amateur astronomers who intercept a faint signal from an alien race and stumble upon something potentially world-changing. Now, they shot this entire film for about $7,000, and I was so blown away with how good it looks. And what's even more impressive is they got distribution, and they're selling their movie around the world and making apparently good money with it. So the film was shot with three people in a friend's garage on a $600 camera, three LED lights, and a decade-old software, post-production software package. They shot with two lenses, one old and one cheap. One was a Tamron 18-200 zoom, which they bought for about $100, and some vintage glass from the 60s from a brand I'd never even heard of. This is the kind of story we as filmmakers need to hear. We don't hear these stories very often, but I want to highlight these guys so much, and I can't wait for you to hear their inspirational story. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Xander and Elliot Weaver. I'd like to welcome to the show Elliot and Xander Weaver, man. How you guys doing?
Very well. Thank you, Alex. Thank you very much for having us on the show.
Oh, awesome. Man. Thank you for being on the show, man. You know, it's I get bombarded with requests to be on the show all the time. And they're like, hey, I made this really low budget movie. And that was cool like 5 years ago. Like I made a movie for $5,000. Like that's cool, but I get 30 of those a week. So it's not, I need something a little extra. And I actually, you guys came up on my radar with your film Cosmos a little while ago. We've been trying to do this for a while now, by the way. So everyone listening, the reason why it's taken so long is schedules, technology, all sorts of things to finally get to where we're at. But I saw what you're doing and I was pretty blown away by not just the efficiency and the cost and all that stuff that you did. You know, you did the movie for about $7,000, as you told me, but the camera you used, and we'll talk about that, and 5 years. And I say that with like, oh, God, help you. You know, all that stuff.
I feel pain.
I feel it, brother. I feel it. But I just love what you're doing, and the quality and everything looks so great. So we're going to get deep into Cosmos today. But before we do that, how did you get into this ridiculous business?
I think this is a story of many people who make movies and love movies. We've been doing it since we were kids, you know, and the first film we actually made, Elliot was 5 years old and I was three, and we got the home video camera and we made a film called When the Toys Came to Life, When the Toys Come Alive, and our toys in our bedroom came to life. And after that, we were hooked, and all through high school, we were making shorts with our mates and making music videos for them and stuff. And we decided to just go straight from high school and jump in. You know, we didn't go to a film school. We didn't go to a university. There aren't really the same kind of level of establishment like there are over in the US for film school options. So we just thought we'd jump straight in, get some experience, and start trying to, you know, find our feet in the industry, really. But yeah, passionate since very small, very, you know, early days.
So the question is, did you sue Pixar for stealing Toy Story from you guys? Is the question?
Not yet. Yeah, but you know, we're working on it. It might fund the next movie.
I broke the story here. Pixar stole, they saw your short, stole your idea, and has made billions of dollars.
Okay. We were like seven or six and we were fuming. In the cinema, we were like ready to table flip and just walk out. This is our IP, right?
It's our first taste of, you know, the industry screwing us over.
Just sippy cups flying everywhere. It was just rough back then, I'm saying.
Storming out of his birthday party. That's disgraceful.
Can you imagine?
They did it better, to be fair. I'll give them that.
Okay, give them that.
They did it. Was the production a little bit better than yours? Just slightly?
Just a little bit.
Just slightly. So let's talk about Cosmos, man. How did Cosmos come to be?
Cosmos came about because we were actually trying to set up another project. As Xander said, when we left school, we both tried to jump into it and set our hearts on directing a feature film, you know, finally getting around to this thing that we'd waited to get out of high school to do. And we set this project up, we started writing a script, and we kind of faced that challenge that all indie filmmakers face, which is, do we write a script we know we can achieve, or do we write the script we'd love to see?
And love to make,
but, and we'll cross that bridge later. And of course, being like 19 and 21 years old, we wrote the script we wanted to see.
Obviously.
And thought, well, you know, we'll cross that bridge, and then we had to cross that bridge. So we were talking to finance, and we were talking to investors, and we got a crew together, and it was all looking really, really good. But understandably, we were young guys and we were asking for something like 5 million quid for a budget or something, because it all snowballed for the people we got involved. It was going really well. And all the investment people kept going, this is fantastic. Your story sounds great. It's fantastic. Crew look good. But, you know, you haven't done this before and you're young and it's a lot of money to ask. And we were like, yes.
I mean, a reasonable.
You make a good point.
I mean, I'm just saying, it's like the equivalent of saying, hey, I need 5 million to build a house. I've never built a house before. Exactly. I've seen it on TV. It seems fairly easy. So, and by the way, at the end of a $5 million house, you have a house. At the end of a $5 million movie, maybe you'll make money. Maybe you won't.
So we were like, okay, you know, reasonable concerns. They kept saying, go away and make a film and prove that you can make a movie. And we were frustrated because we were like, this is what we're trying to do. Anyway, we put that initial film on the shelf, which was called Encounter, went back to the drawing board and went, okay, let's probably do what we should have always have done. Look at what we've got available. You know, we've got lots of computer screens. We've got a station wagon, you know, our dad's kind of Volvo car. We love astronomy and all this sort of thing. What can we... You know, Robert Rodriguez filmmaking, what can we make a movie out of that we've already got? And that's how Cosmos was born. And our initial concept was to make it in about 12 to 18 months and then go back to those investors and go, hey, there you go. Look, there's a Blu-ray. Told you we could do it. Let's get back to business. But because we wanted to do it the way we wanted to do it, where we could prove we had or hopefully prove that we knew what we were talking about and we could take a script and deliver it. We wanted to basically do as much of it as we could ourselves. And that meant it took a lot longer, but...
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
We fell in love with the project and we just ran with it. And it took 5 years in the end, but we're thrilled with the journey.
So you, I mean, I'm assuming you made this on the weekends and whenever you had spare time and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, initially we did. So the first, basically the first year and a half of the work on the film. So the writing of it, the casting of it, finding locations, costumes, making the props and everything. The first year and a half of the movie was done in our spare time while we were freelancing. And we run a production company as well, independent production company that makes TV documentaries. Then from the end of 2015 onwards, we were like, if we're going to make this happen, we've got to commit to it. So we went full time on it. It sounds a bit rock and roll. It's not rock and roll, but we lived off the royalties from our documentary production, which is something that we talk about to filmmakers a lot. We say, you know, if you're looking for that liberation to be able to spend the time making your feature film, your narrative feature, consider making some TV documentaries and getting them out on the market and letting them do some work for you. So those documentaries gave us that freedom. And for the next 3 years or two and a half years, we worked full time on the movie.
Now, what was the crew situation like?
The crew situation was limited, right? So we had, on the production crew, there was three of us, and that was myself, Xander, and our mom. And we did...
That's awesome!
We did everything, right? We did everything. So we rigged all the gear, we lit the sets, we rigged the mics, we shot, we did all the props. We did the lot, basically. We directed as well.
There's that thing.
And for the shoot was 55 days spread over a year. Basically, we shot in blocks, and that was dictated because the actors, were busy and they had other commitments, and we tried to work around their commitments. And then in post-production, it was predominantly the two of us, Sandra and I. And then we worked with a composer over about 3 months to do the soundtrack. So again, it was just Xander and I for like 28 months of just post-production, just staring at computer screens and just chugging away through it. It seems like it's a mad way to make a film. But again, from the very beginning, our objective was we want something that we can show people and that they can look at. Basically, they can't take anything away from us. They can't sit there and go, well, you know, it was well edited, but that was because you hired a professional editor, wasn't it? Or it's well graded, but that's because you hired a professional color grader. We wanted to, for better or worse, whether it ended up being a good film or a bad film, we wanted to have something that we could show these investors and they could go, so apart from acting in it and writing the soundtrack, everything else is you. And we can go, yeah, now, on our next movie, we don't want to do that. We want to work with people who have honed their craft and they're masters of their skill and they can bring so much to it. But at least hopefully it demonstrates that, you know, we have an understanding of visual effects and we have an understanding of editing and we have an understanding of Foley and all this sort of stuff. We don't want to do it professionally, but at least we can be part of those conversations as directors. That was the aim. Anyway,
so I mean, I've heard of these stories of projects going on for 5 years and it generally never ends well. it generally doesn't end well when you hear like, yeah, we've been making this movie for 5 years. You're like, oh, okay. And if it's some, I've worked on features that took that long to make and it just never got released. Just they paid it, they did it, and they just couldn't get it sold because it was either too bad or for whatever reason. So that you guys actually got it to the finish line, and it looks as good as it did, and it made as much noise as it did, is a feat in itself, man. It really, really. I mean, you guys are definitely the Indie Film Hustle personification. There's no question about it, because to stay on a project for 5 years, man, you got to be committed. And that also says a lot about you as filmmakers. You know, if I'm an investor, I'm like, these guys are serious, man. They stuck on this thing for 5 years, better or worse. And there's a reason why it took them this long. It's not because they were crazy. It's because they didn't have any money. And if they would have had a decent budget, this could have been done within a year, all in. Now you chose the Blackmagic pocket camera, which has just a dear place in my heart because I shot my last film on the pocket camera as well. I've been saying this for a while. It's a stunning image. It's gorgeous. It's 1080p. I don't care. It's gorgeous.
We totally agree. We think it's this unsung hero of the indie filmmaking world, and it's complete. It's quite overlooked, actually. We shot the film in 2015. We started shooting the film in 2015. And the pocket camera, the original pocket camera, I think, did it come out in 2013?
Something like that. Yeah.
And we saw the footage start coming through online of people doing camera tests, and we were just absolutely blown away by it. We just thought it just has such this filmic quality to it. It just looks absolutely lovely. So as soon as we could, we were freelance cameramen at the time, and we bought the camera to use for work. And then we were like, this is it. We've got to use this for Cosmos. So it served us incredibly well. There are bumps in the road with the camera. Battery life, for example, is no good. The screen's a bit iffy and all that kind of stuff. But once you've got all those things in place, what you've got effectively when you buy the camera is this beautiful sensor, really. We were very happy with the results of the film. So much so, actually, afterwards we approached after the film was released, we approached Blackmagic and they gave us to give away to the filmmaking community, which was wonderful. Like, to have that association and that affiliation with them was a real moment of pride.
Yeah. What I love about the camera. Yes. The battery power, I use the juice box. So I just used to have with the juice box, it lasts. We shoot 6 hours.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It keeps going.
It just goes and goes and goes. So with the juice box, it was solid, that part. And then I got did you guys get the speed booster?
We did get the speed booster. Yeah, Metabones. Yeah,
the Metabone speed booster just automatic gives you another stop and a half. It's wonderful. And yes, the monitor in the back can have issues. But you could plug in if you're so inclined, a little monitor, pop it out or something like that if you want to. But the speed that you the speed you can move, the size of it. Now they have the 4K pocket camera, or actually the 6K pocket camera. 4K is old school now. They have the 6K pocket camera as well. So they have these other versions that are a little bit more beefy, but this has this Super 16 style. Yeah. It's a Super 16 image. It's a sensor. It's a Super 16 sensor. So for me, like with my film, I wanted that like 1990s Sundance indie vibe with a little bit of grain. I actually added, it was too clean. I added grain to the image in post. But it's such a beautiful camera. Now, what lenses did you use?
We shot most of the movie actually on a single stills lens that we had, a 28mm 1960s stills lens that we just had
vintage
for stills photography. Right? Yeah. And it just, like you said, I don't know what it is about that sensor, but the way sort of the light blooms and it does have like a grainy, although it's obviously digital noise, it does have a grainy look to it. It looks like film grain.
Yeah, but it's pretty clean. If you shoot it right, it's clean. But the aesthetic of the image has that Super 16 clean look, and if you just add just a little bit of digital grain to it, which is a little film grain onto it on top of it, it could just take it to that other beautiful.
It was perfect for our needs. You know, Cosmos is a film set predominantly in this car, in a station wagon. So we had to get a camera and all the, a slider and stuff inside this car and shoot in the confines of the vehicle. And to have this small camera was just absolutely
Have been able to do it otherwise. You would have to have, cut the car in half and fly in and out and all this kind of stuff. Like, I actually
in there.
Yeah, like I own the Blackmagic 4.6K camera, but I chose to shoot with the little camera because of the ease. Even if you would have had a Red or an Alexa, you couldn't have shot this film.
We couldn't. We say that to people sometimes, and they kind of look at us and they go, "What do you mean?" And you go, Well, I mean, it's tough to get a camera in a car. Like, it's not, it's actually our car. It's not a set. You know, we're filming inside. Can't chop the roof off. We've got to drive home.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So yeah, it is, and also it's HD, it's 1080p, and again, some filmmakers look at you like, you know, you've landed from Mars if you're shooting HD. It's like, but it doesn't matter to me, and it doesn't matter in general. But B, there is something beautiful about, like, film is high resolution, but it's soft. It's a delicate image. It's not pin sharp, crystal clear, high fidelity. And I think the 1080p Blackmagic, it has the same texture that film has. It's a pin sharp image if you want it, and it's clean, like you said, but
it's soft.
It's painful.
It just softens the edges in a way that film does. I've talked to Blackmagic a lot about this when I work with them, and I've told them that camera is just like, and all of their images, they always have this kind of like beautiful, like it's like red is freaking just scalpel-esque in their image. It's so crystal clear. It's a bit much. Where Alexa is also a soft image, but the Alexa costs $80,000 to $100,000, as opposed to the Blackmagic and all of that. Now, one thing I found interesting about your story is that you had a soundstage. Obviously, they don't say this publicly enough, but you had a soundstage. It was your garage. You actually built a garage soundstage where you shot a lot of the film in. Can you explain that process, sirs?
Well, the garage is actually a friend of ours. So we one of the challenges that we faced is that the actual set of the movie is this car, but it was the vehicle that we would use to get from the garage every single day. So you know, at the end of filming, we would at the beginning of the day we'd get there and we'd get all the gear out and we'd set the props up in the vehicle and we'd shoot, and then by the end of the day, we had to de-rig everything, put it all back in the car and drive off. We couldn't leave it all set up. That would have been too easy, right? But the film takes place across one night, effectively. And instead of having the car out in the middle of the field and shooting actually in the middle of the night for the interiors, we just drove it into this garage. We put up a black psych and we shot during the day and faked it as if it was at nighttime. And it worked superbly well, but we did all start going a bit doolally by the end of it because we weren't seeing any daylight. It was middle of the winter here in the UK, and we drive in the dark, shoot in the dark all day, and drive out in the dark. So yeah, we craved the lunchtime daylight that we got every day.
Now, I wanted to go back real quick to the whole 1080p aspect. Did you shooting on 1080p affect your distribution deal, your sales? Did they go, oh no, we can't take your film because we need 4K? Because this is a myth. People think you have to master in 4K.
Yeah.
You have to shoot in 6 or now 12K or something like that. Please tell the people the truth. Did it matter?
No, it doesn't matter. Well, it didn't matter to us. We spoke to a handful of distributors. We spoke to a handful of sales agents. We even got two distributors bidding against each other for the film. And even when we'd settled on one and were signing all the deals up, not once in the sort of 6 months that we were doing distribution and since have we been asked about what resolution the film was shot on. Not once did they ask us during the negotiation process, what resolution is it? You know, what did you shoot on? It didn't matter. And in fact, when we got the deliverable, the tech specs, in the tech specs for our distributor, it actually said, if you have shot your film in 4K, can you please let us know? Because we will have to set up a special pipeline for you. Basically, not many people do that. You know, in other words, not many people do that, and we'll have to go a special route for you. So, yeah, not once were we asked, is it in 2K, 4K, 6K? They watched the screener, and that's all they really wanted to talk about. So we often get asked to. We get emailed by people going, oh, you shot on the 6K. I read you shot on the Blackmagic 6K. And we're like, no, we shot on the original. And they're like, the 4K. You're like, no, the original, the 1080p.
Yeah, same thing happens to me.
Yeah.
Or this will happen, right? They'll get in touch and they'll say, we watched the movie, you know, really impressed with what you achieved with your limited resources. And you're like, oh, that's amazing. Thank you. And they say, what camera did you shoot on? And you tell them. And like Elliot said, they assume it's 6K or 4K.
4K.
And you go, no, it's the 1080p one. And they go, really? I'm shocked. And it's like, well, you watched it. So like, do you, like, did it work for you? Did it distract from the story for you? Or did you just watch it and enjoy it and not really worry? So yeah, I think it's very easy to get lost in the kind of K-war with all the modern technology. But ultimately, I think as storytellers, our focus should be more on the script and the acting and the soundtrack.
Stop it.
On how many Ks.
Stop it. Yeah. Stop it, sir. You're talking crazy talk, sir. Crazy talk. It's all about the cameras. It's all about the gear. If you've got a 12K camera, if you have an Alexa with a $100,000 lens on it, that's all you need. You don't need a story or acting. That automatically makes your movie good. Isn't that? That's what I've been sold. That's what I've been told. Am I wrong?
That's what I've been told too. Yeah. I mean, we also get asked, you know, what codec we shot in, and we shot. People go, oh, you shot RAW then, right? And we shot ProRes LT.
Okay. Well, that's now honestly. Okay, now I'm gonna have to say that is kind of crazy talk. Why didn't you shoot RAW? Come on, guys. You could have shot RAW. Well, wait a minute. But you edited in Final Cut, which we'll get to in a minute. So RAW would have been a big pain in the butt for you.
It would have been. I mean, we did our own little camera tests. We put our nose to the screen, and we were like,
LT. You shot an LT, not even ProRes.
Couldn't even tell the difference.
LT. Yeah.
We did HQ, ProRes, and an LT tests, and we were like, looking at our monitor, you know, our Mac monitor, going, which one is this? I can't tell. So
we also wanted to we're big fans of like committing on location to like basically what it looks like and how it's lit and the color and, you know, and so because those are the directors that we look up to from our childhood, you know, they didn't have that kind of flexibility that is now available to filmmakers. And I think it can hone your abilities and your craft. So to some degree, we wanted to test ourselves and go, look, we're going to bake this in. We're going to just shoot. And what we get is what we get. And we're going to live with it. And that to us is part of the thrill and excitement of filmmaking.
It's crazy, man. Crazy talk, you guys. Crazy talk. And but you also had a limited theatrical, right?
We did, yeah.
But how could you do that with a 1080p? That's not possible, sir. How could you do that? Explain.
Well, it's a great question. It held up beautifully on mm-hmm. screen. We did actually do an up-res, 2K up-res for the DCP using DaVinci Resolve's upscale, which is nuts. In fact, I've heard that many people are selling their Blackmagic 6Ks and 4Ks, going back to the originals and just up-resing them because they prefer the image, how it looks on the original. But we had a limited theatrical release. The movie was in 9 cities across the states, which was just mad for us, right? We were not anticipating that. Like two kids from Birmingham, UK, making a movie and it's going to be shown in cinemas in America. That was a dream come true. And we've seen it. We saw it twice on a big screen. We had a premiere here in the UK, a premiere out in Los Angeles as well. And it just really holds up incredibly well, considering. I just wish that filmmakers could, you know, stop worrying so much about it, because the kit that we've got available at our fingertips now is just so incredibly powerful.
Yes.
And there is just no excuse, I think.
No, that's another reason why I wanted you guys on the show, because you shot with this camera, because I shot with the camera as well. And everyone says all the same things you get, I've gotten with my film. And I did the same thing, like, because on my monitor here where I color graded, it looked great. But when I premiered at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood with my film, and I was like, this is amazing. But do you understand? I was terrified. I just up-resed. Yeah. I did a DP, a DCP up-res to 2K. I'm like, I don't know.
Is it going
to
work?
I don't know what it's going to look like. I'm like, is it going to be super grainy? I'm like, okay, well, it's supposed to be kind of grainy because I wanted it. And when I saw it projected in the Chinese, and I just sat there before the audience came out, and we did a little tech scout on it, I was like, oh my, it looks amazing. It's gorgeous. It was so, and we did the DCP through to DaVinci, and I was just blown away. It's honestly, and I've shot with all the cameras known to man, 35, 16, I've shot everything. It's probably one of the most beautiful things I've ever shot. That film.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's such a great camera. And that's why I want people listening to understand You can buy that little camera right now on eBay for $600 to $800.
Yeah, maybe less.
Maybe less. And you can find, you can buy the full, like a full kit for like $1,000, $1,200, and that comes with like a lot. I mean, I bought mine off of eBay. I bought it like for I think $1,000, but it was like a full kit, case, batteries, all of that stuff. And then to rig it out.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
It doesn't cost that much. Like, if you need a mat box, I got my mat box for like $150. It's so you could really, you can pimp it out, man. You can pimp it out really, really.
I actually made our camera rig out.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, yes. So please tell us about your rig, sir.
Yeah, we actually put up a video on our Facebook page a few months back just to show people because they kept we'd spoken about the fact that I'd made this rig, and I don't think some people believed that it was actually true, but yeah, it's one of those very kind of Heath Robinson held together with gaffer tape kind of affairs, really. But just, you know, I was looking online. We didn't have a budget for this movie. I was looking online, and there's some wonderful rigs out there, but I think there's like two kinds, right? There's these lovely machine milled, beautiful things, right, that are quite expensive.
Yeah, and then $1,000, yeah.
Super cheap plastic ones, and you think, oh, they're going to snap when I first use them. So I just thought, because we had some very specific requirements with Cosmos of getting in the car and being able to adjust the rig setup and what we wanted to do with it, I was like, why don't I just make a custom one? So went to the hardware store, got some wood, got some copper pipe, got some nails, and just put it all together, really. And you could see it in the behind the scenes. It's not pretty, right? It's not. But
that's part of the fun of this film.
It's our baby, all right?
It's part of the fun of this film. You know, we are very proud and very, like, humbled by how well it has done. But we're also really excited because we've done it in sort of the most kit-bashed ad hoc way. You know, we've got a cardboard mat box and we've got ankle weights on the back of our rig and we're using a wheelchair for a dolly and it doesn't matter. Or it doesn't matter to us at least. And it wasn't about standing behind a camera with our cap on and posing and looking cool. It was about making a film no matter what. And it wasn't about being cool and being seen with a Red Epic or an Alexa.
Yeah.
We'd love to work with that, you know, it would be a dream. But we forwent that sort of the image of feeling good about ourselves in exchange for actually being able to get a film made.
Yeah, no, when I saw the behind the scenes and I saw you guys in a wheelchair, I was like, oh, Robert, Mr. Rodriguez has helped us out so much because he's the first. I mean, I'm a bit older than you guys, so I came up around the same time Robert did. I speak of him like I'm his friend. I'm not. But Robert, he did the wheelchair thing with El Mariachi, and I did a wheelchair thing. Everybody of my generation did the wheelchair. And to be honest with you, this is how I got, because wheelchairs are expensive. They're not cheap. So what we did, this is back in 94, I think, we went to the mall where you could rent a wheelchair for the day for $1.25.
Oh, wow.
But we just took it home.
Morally questionable.
No, wait. Used it, returned it afterwards, got my dollar. I got a quarter back because I returned it. So the essential rental would be, it was just because no one does that. Like, and it was also the 90s and they didn't, you know, and it's a different world. Less cameras in the, you know, security cameras, less security. It was the Wild Wild West. But yes, that was what I do.
Brilliant. That's what it's all about though, right?
That's the indie film hustle.
No, man, it's just I've been living the brand since 92, sir.
It's a genuine article.
What is the biggest mistake you made making this film? I'm sure there's a list, but what's the one that you're like, oh,
I think the biggest, well, see, this is an interesting question. The thing that we often say we would do differently is we would just get some help, right? We would raise a bit of money, right? We wouldn't just do it all on our own.
Two people.
Seems very obvious.
Like two people, three people, maybe. Two people.
But the challenge that the reason it's not that simple actually for us is because part of the marketing for Cosmos has been leveraging this kind of indie film spirit. It's been connecting with the filmmaking community by saying, look, we're just doing this with nothing, follow us along, be part of it.
Sure.
And so if we'd have done it how most other people do it, where they pull a band together and they kickstart and they raise $20,000 or mm-hmm. something, then you're just the same as everybody else, right? So to some degree, this nuts, stupid way of doing a movie took ages, but it paid off because it's allowed us to open up conversations. We're talking to you now because of it. We wouldn't mm-hmm. be otherwise. So mm-hmm. I would say if I wanted to get it done quicker with less stress, I just collaborate with more people, get it done sooner. But, you know, I'm very proud of like the way we've done it and the experience that we've obtained from it is just like, God, it's immeasurable. To just have a bit of a glimpse and an understanding about all these elements and aspects
sure.
of the process. It's like the ultimate film school. So it's a really interesting question.
What did mom do since she was your third crewman? Crewwoman.
She was essential. So our mom, professionally, not anymore, but before we were born and while we were kids, she was a professional TV makeup artist. So she, one of the main disciplines that she had on the film was she was hair and makeup.
Sure.
And that obviously rolled over into continuity. So she was keeping track of all the beard length and the hair length and the collars and all that sort of thing. And then we did also just like rope her in and put her to good use doing the clapperboard every now and then, and sometimes holding the boom and sometimes running the smoke machine around. She was sort of almost like the third director, really. Yeah. We were all in it together, but she was also, we often say, she was the on-set mom, and every set needs a mom, you know. Mm-hmm. And all the boys, all the guys, they kind of she mothered them and they adopted her, so we had this sort of
family
yeah. unit on the film. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what did you guys use for a smoke machine? Did you actually like buy one of those like party smoke machines, or
we already had like a mister, like a disco smoke machine type
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And we tested it outside and we're like, this is just not going to hack it. You know, like in the windy British winter, it's like, okay, it's
like someone's just lit a cigarette. It's yeah. like, that's not going to work.
So actually the single biggest expense on the movie, we bought a gas powered Artem smoke machine.
Yeah. So one of the propane ones that you see on.
The proper jobs, you know, but for us, we could justify it in our heads because we were just like, this is going to give us a production value. We're going to be out in a forest and it's going to give us the depth and allow us to kind of make it look like we have more lights than we do. And, you know, we're big fans of like having that smoke medium to light in and all that stuff. So for us, it was...
It was over 10% of the budget on the smoke machine.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I want to ask you something because I've shot with a ton of haze machines and smoke machines in my career. And you guys didn't shoot raw. So I know from shooting with smoke machines that smoke doesn't take direction quite well. How Tony Scott shot every scene of every movie that he ever did with a smoke machine or a haze machine, and it looked perfect every time. How he did it, I don't know. I can only imagine. I've had trouble with full crews. How the hell did you wrangle smoke or haze in a shot, and how did you match it in post, and how did you deal with it in color? Because sometimes if it's one shot's hazy and then the coverage is not hazy, how did you do it?
Well, with difficulty, I think.
It was hard as hell, Alex. I have to tell you, it was ridiculously hard.
It was almost impossible. We almost set everything on fire, and third degree burns and the whole lot, really. So we did get quite good at like timing the smoke machine, so we could sort of like leave it off on its own and it would just trickle out on its own. Very against the rules of owning a propane gas smoke machine is never leave it unattended, but you know, we were all grown ups. So
you were only a few feet away. You were a few feet away. It was
We also did a blast, right? We'd like one of us would run around with the smoke machine, blast it into the grass and all that kind of stuff. And then you step back and it'd just be this enormous fog cloud, right? You'd be behind the camera ready. Actors will be ready. Wait for it. Wait for the moment. Wait for the, you know. And then just when it was right, we went for it.
I have to point something out that you were judging me morally about my wheelchair scam. Sir, you left a propane machine unattended, sir, which actually could have killed people. My little scam did not kill anybody, and it was returned, sir.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So both of you, I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. I take everything back. I'm sorry.
So even in post though, like matching that haze. Yeah. And
we did do a bit of that.
Yeah, we did. For the most part, it was okay. Like we'd for one reason or another, we didn't have too much problems, but we did. Good. There's always that balance, isn't there, when you come to your color grade and you
did a bit of smoke stuff in post. Copying and pasting backgrounds and paste. Zan, can you just take the smoke from behind this guy's head in this shot?
Yeah.
And put it in this guy, and he would just be like, okay.
You have to. I mean, it's. I just want people that hearing this understand: shooting with a smoke machine or haze machine, it's not easy. And it's time consuming. It is, you shoot it up, settle, wait, shoot, cut, do it again. And then you guys, I've only done it inside. I've never done it outside. So I can only imagine shooting it outside. And you guys had
direction as well. Like you'll be, for 10 minutes, it'll be blowing left to right. And then suddenly you'll be like, I'll put the smoke machine over there. You know, it's you chasing your tail all night long.
Now, can you talk everybody, because you guys did purchase a very high, expensive wind machine. So can you tell people what that wind machine was?
Yes, absolutely. Well, in the spirit of all high-end special effects that you see in all the blockbusters, we went into our garden shed and we were digging around and we were aware that, you know, once upon a time, we were the proud owners of a leaf blower. So we got that Dyson leaf blower out, gave it a bit of a blast and thought, okay, well, we can't record any dialogue while using this, but we can have wind. So yeah, that was one of our jobs. In fact, my job on the end of the shoot, I was directing and blowing hot, dusty air into the faces of the actors.
So you were just directing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
It was method.
Yeah. Turn the wind machine on.
You wanted them to cry, so you just slam dirt into their eyes, basically, at high speed.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's... teary, glossy-eyed look. That's great. Oh, that's sorry. Awesome. No, you've just got leaves in your face.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Now, what I want to talk about post, because when I read what you guys did in post, again, made my heart just it warmed my heart, because you were using two pieces of software that I used on. I'm a recent convert from Final Cut 7. When I say recent, it was probably like 4 or 5 years, I switched to editing to in Resolve strictly. But 7 solid, and with 1080p, and you guys were shooting a ProRes, so. With my first film, I had to actually go to Resolve because I was shooting RAW on the old cinema camera, the original 2.5K cinema camera. So I had to go RAW because I'm like, finally, I have to leave poor Final Cut 7. So you edited in Final Cut 7, and then you colored in Color 2, Apple Color, if I'm not mistaken, right?
We did.
I did a lot of Apple Color.
Sound design in Final Cut 7 as well.
You guys are doing, and what year was this?
This was, 2018, 2017, so
truly no excuse. So, because I'm saying, because I did all this in like 2006. So there is, no excuse. No, but you had what you had. And that's, again, that's another great lesson here. You have it, you own it, use what you got.
That's it. That's what it's all about. And for us, we produce all of our documentaries using Final Cut 7.
It's a system.
And our philosophy is just like, look, there's been Oscar winning movies that been edited on Final Cut 7. We have no requirement to push to a new piece of software. We're not shooting in 4K or 8K or something crazy. We're shooting in 1080p. If it's good enough.
Well, Parasite won the best Oscar.
Yeah, yeah.
Shot on, edited on Final Cut 7.
Yeah,
no,
that's right.
So, Parasite was edited in Final Cut 7?
Yeah, it was.
So, you know, we just think.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's still going strong. There's a small band of FCP7 users who are like, come on, keep it alive.
It's a great piece of software. It's a great piece of software. Though I do like Resolve a little bit better than Color, I have to say.
We're in the process of kind of switching over to Resolve for all things generally, really. You know, cutting and grading as well. So, I mean, just black magic all the way.
No. And that's another thing that I want people to understand is, like, if you stay within the black magic ecosystem, man, it works beautifully. Like, you shoot raw, bring it into Resolve, and you can do everything in Resolve, and then you don't have to actually even go out to online anywhere. It all stays in. Visual effects are connected. Sound is connected. It's a pretty amazing piece of software.
You're talking about some kind of unknown future world to us, Alex. No, we're still dealing with Final Cut 7 and Color 3.
Where's my USB stick?
Get the floppy disk.
Get the floppy disk. No, get the zip disk, sir. Get the zip disk. The zip disk and the jazz. Do you know what a jazz drive is?
No.
Do you know what a zip disk? Do you know what a zip disk is?
I don't know. You guys are so young.
You're so young.
That's floppy disk, right?
No, a floppy disk was a 1.2 meg, if I'm not mistaken, disk that held 1.2 meg. The zip disk held 100 megs, and it was like a plastic disk. And then the jazz was the big brother of the zip. It was all by iOmega. It was a company. This now I'm dating myself, and only like 5% of my audience is going, oh, I remember that. No, I'm apparently much older than you guys. Extremely much older than you guys.
Well, we used floppies at school. Yeah. High school, putting our coursework on floppy disks. The USB, the whole flash drive thing was like, wow, what a, it was magic.
It's like science fiction, isn't it?
Yeah. And now it's like, oh, here's USB stick.
We were talking to someone not long ago, and they were talking about MP3 players, weren't they? Or something. What was it? And they said, they were saying something like, oh, apparently there was a time when MP3 players couldn't do this. And we were just like, oh my God. Like, there wasn't a time when MP3 players existed. Like,
there was a thing called tapes, CDs, records, 8-track. I remember 8-track vaguely in a car when I was a kid. I remember an 8-track tape. Anyway, I'm so effing old. I appreciate you. You're reminding me. Thank you.
Tape cassettes for children of the tape.
Oh, I love a tape cassette.
Recording your mixtapes on the radio and
waiting for the radio. Just like I'm hoping the DJ does not say a damn word over the song.
Later in life, when you hear the song and you're like, "This isn't right. Where's that weird outro?"
Yes, because you hear the song 1,000 times and you're like, "Hey, welcome back!" Like, and you're just waiting for that.
You can actually mouth it yourself. It's like, I know it off my heart.
Oh my god, I used to do that all the time. Because you guys were the DPs in this as well, and it looks, by the way, fantastic. It looks gorgeous. So that's extremely impressive. What I love about the film is that you really made it. You gave so much production value, but yet in a very very small space. Really, it was a small group of characters, and a lot of people think that you have to make a very contained movie like yours, which is contained, but it wasn't contained. There's like big outside scenes, and there's excitement and things like that, but it doesn't have to be in a room. I mean, you can think outside the box a little bit, and it's still very, but you did a car. But it was a car with outside and you know, the sky, and there was a lot of production value and all the stuff that you did with it. But the look of the film is really great. When you got into Color, though, how much did you do? Was it like you guys were close to where you wanted to be? And that's scary, man. I'm letting you know. I've been a colorist for 10, 12 years. I have to shoot raw because I need that freedom to like save me from me.
Well, I think it's the right thing to do. Yeah. It's the sensible.
It is the correct, sensible thing to do, is what you're saying.
It is, okay. Sure. I mean, why not is the real answer to that question. Why would you not use those tools that are available? But yeah, no, we shot, as we previously mentioned, we lit with the colors we wanted it, you know, how we wanted it to be lit. We're big fans of splashing color in there.
And, oh, very yeah. Nice, Scott. Tony,
I mean,
throw it in, you know.
And we're not likening ourselves to.
No,
No. Okay. Just like Tony Scott, this is what I do.
Yeah.
No, we understand. Yeah, we understand, Tony. Rest in peace, Tony. But I mean, Tony and Ridley both.
Yeah,
just
visual is amazing. Beautiful. So we our goal was to just capture that as much as possible on location, and then
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
When we got to the color grade, for the most part, it was a few kind of vignette power windows here and there. We did some tests early on when we were comparing the Blackmagic footage to film footage. And we noticed that film had like a kind of slight greeny, yellowy tint in the highlights. That's something we just saw. And so we just pushed a bit of that in, up the saturation, up the contrast ever so slightly. It was a very, it was a time-consuming process, because it always is, isn't it, with the color matching and everything. But in terms of how much we pushed the image, we didn't do a huge amount to it. We were quite delicate with it.
And how about visual effects? Because there's a couple of visual effects in the movie.
There's 70 visual effects in the film.
How many?
170, yeah.
Nice.
Most of them are not visible. We call them invis effects, because they're just not even supposed to be noticed. They're like set extensions and skylines and stars in the sky and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I handled the visual effects while Elliot was doing all the sound design and the Foley for the film. I did the visual effects on Blender, which is this fantastic open source VFX software. Is just getting stronger and stronger, and man, it's exciting to see what they're doing with it, pioneering stuff. And After Effects as well. But for the most part, like I said, it was some set extensions, some skylines, but there were more involved things. For example, the front of the telescope, we replaced the front end of the telescope in the movie because it looked pretty awful. Actually, it was originally a tripod carry tube, and we created a prop for the front to make it look like a telescope. And then we got into the edit, and we were like, "That just does not sell."
Rubbish,
absolute trash. And so Elliot turned to me and he said, "Can we do something about that?" So I had to figure that out. It was very much a learning process as we went. I always say that, like, when it came to the visual effects, it was something I was doing for fun before Cosmos was even a consideration. So if you ever get that kind of tinge of excitement about anything, just explore it a bit, because for filmmaking, it's such a diverse discipline. There's so many different elements to it. Chances are it'll come back and help you at some point.
And you, yeah. So you comped in After Effects, you did comp in After Effects, visual effect, 3D in Blender 3D, Final Cut Edit, and color. And then you also mastered sound in Final Cut, which I know is ridiculous because I've done it myself. It's not really built an audio.
Not at all.
Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit. And then you guys also did Foley as well.
Yeah, we did the lot. Yeah, we did the Foley, and I did that. So while Xander was doing the visual effects, I was stomping around and rustling and breathing into microphones and all that sort of thing. And
that's amazing.
66,000 sound effects we put in onto 100 audio tracks. So
what machine were you running? Because I know Final Cut 7 fairly well. That's going to tax the software, sir.
Yeah, it did. I just a Mac, an iMac.
iMac.
An iMac with an operating system that still runs Final Cut 7, because now officially it's dead. You can't upgrade.
Yes, that is absolutely right. We have two iMacs, right? This one, which is up to date, and the one we made Cosmos on, which we cannot change.
Also, the Mac is like dead now. You turn it on and you just try and open up Chrome or something. You just think, we killed this computer trying to make that film.
Yeah. I know the feeling.
It just wants to retire. It wants to be put out to graze. You know?
Is it something about Macs that I still have three towers? of old Max that I can't get rid of him. There's just something like I can't get rid of my Mac. I don't like just in case you need that CD-ROM for some reason.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, absolutely. We've got a PC here with a floppy disk drive on it, so you know, got to keep the options open. You know,
keep the art alive.
Just in case everything goes to hell, you got Final Cut 7. Let's rock and roll.
That's it. I'm on a floppy, and we're in business.
Now, so you finished this whole movie. You're ready. It's been 5 years, and you're like, okay, let's get this out to the world. Tell me your adventures in distribution.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so we finished the film, and we then set about putting together the marketing materials that we thought we would need in order to get a distributor. So we did our own poster, and we cut our own trailer, and we put a screener together, and all that sort of thing. And then we decided to, in the spirit of the film, continue to do everything ourselves. So
of course, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't we change? Why wouldn't we have learned our lesson after 5 years? We actually tried to submit, or we did submit the film to probably a dozen film festivals, in sort of the tier of film festival that you hope your film might.
So Sundance. Sundance,
South by Southwest.
You donated to Robert Redford's retirement fund. I understand. Yes,
I'm sure he appreciated that. And we obviously got flat out rejected from every festival we submitted to. And then we decided to just sort of, we're trying to get into festivals so we can connect with distributors. But I wonder if we can just connect with those distributors directly. And we spoke to a few filmmakers that we knew who had done that route. And that's what we pursued. So with our marketing material and our screener of our film, we set about reaching out directly and sent out some introductory emails, sent out some screeners, and just started talking to people, really. And we spoke to sales agents as well and tried to suss out whether that was the right route for us. And in the end, we actually got two distributors competing, you know, bidding for the film, and pushed it up the... pushed the bid up and made it more favorable for us, and then ended up going with one that we felt offered us something that was worth, you know, the deal, worth signing up to. And that's what we did. And that process took about 6 months from the day of finishing the film to...
But that's nothing, though. But that's nothing for guys like you. You've already taken, it's taking you 4.5-5 years to make a movie. 6 months for distribution, that's nothing.
Our sense of time is like... We're like 300.
It's like being in a Nolan movie. It's just like, what's going on?
Exactly. 6 months, that's a blink of an eye. it was an interesting process for sure. But we used IMDb Pro's free trial to create a list of distributors that, you know, in the kind of realm that we were looking for. And we just went down that list. And ultimately, it worked out. And we found a home for Cosmos that has done for the most part what we wanted it to do. Although... no distribution story is plain sailing for sure.
Yeah, I haven't heard of one of those yet. That everyone's like, yes, it was fantastic. They only gave me money. I actually didn't know what to do with all the money and attention I was getting. It's generally not something you hear. But generally speaking, though, you're happy with where you went with the distribution company and how things have been, how it's been put out into the world and everything like that. Because look, I've seen it everywhere. And I've seen it pop up a bunch of different places. So I'm assuming that's you guys, as far as marketing is concerned.
Yeah, it is us for sure. Yeah, we're with Gravitas Ventures, and I think their model is very much give it to the producers. They know their movie, they can market it. You know, we'll put it on the platforms. And so as far as we're aware, most of the marketing of the movie is our work, really. You know, we put the poster and the trailer together. We did an ad spend on some social media to try and get it out there. And we're just trying to engage with the filmmaking community and share the process, really, as much as we possibly can. But, you know, we are certainly happy with the reach of the movie. It's available on, you know, many platforms. It's in the US, it's on like Hulu, Tubi, it's on Prime Streaming and Vimeo. It's all the SVOD and VOD options that you could really hope for, to be quite honest. But there's also certainly a strong argument for that kind of independent distribution route where you handle it yourself. If you're doing all the marketing anyway, right? Like, why not make that final step? For us, our goal was very much to be able to finish the movie, give it to somebody else, have control over the marketing, because we didn't want that to be in someone else's hands. We were worried that it could be marketed incorrectly. But to not have all our time spent on getting that movie out there. So to us, it made sense to hand it to somebody else, because we wanted to start writing a new project, start moving forwards, and not get kind of like bogged down in the personal distribution of the movie.
Now, but the other thing is too, you guys had a very different end game for this film. And that's something that's really important for filmmakers to understand listening, is that your goals with the film were not to make $1 million or be, rich or anything like that off the film. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Money's nice. We would like to have money if we can't keep going without it. But because I'm assuming you don't want to do another 5 years like this. I'm assuming this is it. You're not doing any more. No more of these movies. You have to promise me no more. But but your goal was to get it out there and get your name out there for people to see you, to have conversations about other projects, to talk to other investors. That was the end game for this film, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the film has been out 6 months now, and we are starting to move into a phase where the film is making us money, which is great, because that's a real uptick. But you're right. Our goal was, we have the philosophy that, like, we couldn't buy our way into the movie industry, even if we had loads of money. So we've got to find something of value beyond the finances that will allow us to progress as film directors. So if we could trade the financial reward for the exposure and hopefully people liking the movie and the word getting around and maybe people in industry hearing about it and going, oh yeah, I've heard about this film actually, that was more valuable to us as filmmakers. And we do try and stress that to people we talk to and, on things like this, that we're not at all sort of suggesting that this is a business model for
the $7,000 5 year model. Then no, not so much.
No. We were, we run a production company. Aside from this, we've got other projects and other fingers and other pies. The reason we wanted to make this movie initially was as a bargaining chip to get that initial film off the ground. In the end, it was just supposed to be something that we could barter with. But now, it ended up becoming something bigger. And it's actually acting in a way as like a crowbar to open industry doors. And since the film has been released, we've had people from, Hollywood email us, and, we've been talking to managers and we're potentially talking to people. And it has given us that sort of springboard. So yeah, we traded the finances for the potential, to be able to help our career move further along.
But the other thing is that you also didn't make a $200,000 movie and had that goal. Then you made a $7,000 movie.
Yes.
Very, very Robert Rodriguez-esque. It was a nice round 7,000.
Yeah, absolutely. On the dot.
On the dot, exactly. No, that's amazing, guys. You guys are definitely an inspiration, an indie filmed inspiration. And you did it in today's world, but yet a little bit in the past, because it took you 5 years to do, but all the things that you did travel to this point right now, and the basic spirit of what you do is getting out there and doing it. And not everyone needs 5 years. Some might need seven, but you did it, and you did it on your own terms, and you told the story you wanted to tell, and it's doing exactly what you want for it. And God, you can't really ask for, you could ask for a bunch more, but generally speaking, you got what you aimed for.
Yeah, we actually got a lot more than we aimed for. I mean, we've walked away with a movie that people are watching and they're enjoying. And we have people contact us every single day to say, I checked out your movie, we're in lockdown and it's brought me hope, and it's brought, and it sounds corny, right? But like, ultimately, as filmmakers, our goal is to like tell a story that people connect with and to hear that people are enjoying the film and wanting to kind of connect with the community and be part of it. It's an absolute dream. And on top of that, the actors that are in the movie, they've become like family to us, you know, like we've been to the weddings and they've moved houses and we're all part of it together now. And it's been a testing experience, but just an incredible one as well. Very, very lucky.
Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Blimey. I would say... Yeah.
Take 5 years and make
sure. Don't take five
years. Do something nuts.
I would say be passionate. Because I think there are a lot of people, you know, Xander and I talk to a lot of people, we cross paths with filmmakers, and I think you can, and also young crew, you can sort of sniff out the ones who kind of want to be in it because they think it's cool. And it'd be like, I'd love to walk the red carpet and I'd love to be, it's a glitzy glamour industry. And then you can also immediately tell the people that don't care about that at all. They have to do this because they love it so much. And I think the people who are in positions of power can tell why you're sitting in front of them. And if you're passionate and you love it so much, I think that you're going to win them over. So I'd say be passionate about what you,
that's good. What you do. I'd say, really identify like what it is about making movies that is going to make you happy. Like, why do you want to do it? Because if you're doing it for the end goal, if you're doing it because it's going to get you somewhere someday, that's just not really going to get you through those challenging nights where you're, you know, you could Final Cut 7 crashed on you for the 100th time and you're
in the middle of a render and you just lost your edit.
You know, it's to me, a big thing that I've learned through the making of Cosmos has been about just enjoying the process. Don't forget that it's filmmaking that you love, not the next movie, not the movie you'll make in 10 years, not where you'll be or what you could be doing someday. It's right now. And if you're on set with a camera and you're making a movie with actors, you're doing it. You're just doing it. So just enjoy that and try to hold on to that through the whole process.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Things take time.
Yeah, I'm going to say exactly that.
Patience.
Yeah.
Go on, yeah.
Yeah, patience, persistence. Things take time. Things take longer than you ever thought they could. Just accept it and don't fight it. You know, you're doing the best you can.
I remember hearing... There's a phrase that our dad used to tell us, he heard and he told us, and he said that people overestimate what they can achieve in a year, but underestimate what they can achieve in a decade.
Yeah.
And it's like, I remember leaving school at 18 and being like, this is it. You know, by the time I'm 22,
should be any time now, Oscars. Should I get the tux now? What should I do?
You know, and now I'm 32. It's been 14 years since I left school and I've just... You know, it's been 6 months we've released our first film. It took a hell of a lot longer than we thought it would, but we didn't give up and we are now here. So patience. Don't give up. Keep working hard. Love what you do and it will come.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, man.
Definitely E.T.
Yeah, I figured.
Compliment, man.
When I saw Cosmos, I'm like, oh boy, these guys love that Spielberg boy. They just love it.
Steven Spielberg.
We do.
Yeah, I mean, it could easily be three Spielberg films to be top three. But I tell you what, we watched the other day again, first time in a while, Meet Joe Black.
Oh,
didn't you ever seen it?
Yeah, Martin, of course. Brett. Yeah, it's great. Oh, yeah. I love Meet Joe Black. I love Meet Joe Black.
Oh, man, what a movie. Wow, incredible. But yeah, you go on, pick one.
It's hard to pick a favorite movie. I tell you what, not picking a favorite movie, but another good Martin Brest movie is Scent of a Woman.
Oh, yes.
That end scene.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Anything Spielberg, Jaws, Close Encounters.
Jurassic Park.
Raiders. It's all good, man.
We've been mega Spielberg fans.
I mean, you can watch Jaws right now, and it is perfection. It's the shark, I don't care. It's just... perfect. It's exactly what it needs to be. I don't want a CG shark. I want that shark. It's so perfect. And did you know, I'll give you a little bit of Jaws trivia. The scene in the boat where they're drunk. It's the night before the big thing. And what's his name? Oh, the old Robert Shaw is doing that whole like long diatribe about like this dialogue, and he's like talking about the that was actually written by John Milius.
Really?
Spielberg called him like the night before and said, "Hey, John, man, we got to shoot the scene tomorrow, and we need a scene." And John, he's like, "Sure," and he wrote the scene out for him.
Wow! Oh, I'll just type this up for you.
Yeah, but it's like you calling one of your mates and going, "Hey, dude, can you help me out with this shot?" But that's who they were. They're like the young filmmakers, you know.
That's amazing. I mean, it's funny because we'll have this. We'll talk to filmmakers like yourself. And you'll have this phrase like, "What's a perfect film?" And people say Jaws, and suddenly everyone goes, "Oh, Jaws."
Well, I mean, Jaws is a perfect. I mean, it is. It's
everyone agrees.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Yeah, there's. I mean, Spielberg has a few perfect films. I mean, there's. Yeah. He's got a couple in his. You know, and I mean, I could go into the Kubrick. So I can go into Fincher. I can go into Nolan.
So many.
I can go into Marty. I mean, Coppola. I mean, Godfather, obviously.
Ridley Scott. We love Gladiator as well.
Blade Runner. Aliens. If you want to go down the
Cameron is often overlooked, isn't he?
So this is the funny thing about. Okay, there's just film geeks talking, guys. So just bear with us. Cameron, when Titanic came out, I people were like, you know, I don't know how old you guys when Titanic came out.
I was 9. It was school. Have you seen it?
Yeah, no. I was a bit older than you, 97. When everyone, you know, it was a big hoopla, $200 million is going to bomb. Who's going to want to watch Titanic? I mean, we all know how it ends. Like, why would you do that? And I just kept saying to everybody who was saying that, anyone I talked to, I'm like, "In Cameron, I trust." Cameron, I trust because he has yet to make a bad movie. And if you look at his filmography from The Abyss, Aliens, Terminator 2, True Lies.
True Lies is amazing.
He just always delivered. It just always. So then when fast forward a decade and then Avatar, they're saying the same thing about Avatar. I'm like, hey, Cameron, I trust.
Cameron, we trust.
He's one of the most underrated filmmakers, I think, in history. He's one of the most successful filmmakers in history. And the funny thing is that, and I always tell people this, like, do you understand that nobody else could make Avatar? Like, there is no, Spielberg's not getting $500 million to go develop a new IP, new technology about blue people with arguably no major bankable stars, like major stars involved, you know, other like Sigourney, nothing that could support $500 million.
Today's stars, you know?
So nobody, not Peter Jackson, definitely not Fincher, definitely not Nolan, like nobody else could do it other than someone like James Cameron. And there is nobody else. And when you realize, and I've heard these interviews, like, when you're the only person on the planet that could do something, like there's not an argument here. Could Spielberg make a movie like Avatar? Yes, but not by himself. Yeah. He doesn't have the skill set. Cameron is like on a whole other level, like with the technology and Nolan and all, you know, there's just nobody else that could do that film. No one else would write. No one else would get a check for $500 million.
No, you're right. Actually, that's something you quite easily overlook because you just go, "Yeah, it's Cameron."
But you take it for granted. You just take it like, "Oh, yes, it's James Cameron." But there's nobody else.
I love watching behind the scenes footage of him directing, especially on Titanic. So if you see him, he's in the water, camera on his shoulder,
he's in his waders. Just
it's just so inspiring.
Did you guys listen to my interview with Russell Carpenter, the DP from Titanic?
No, we haven't. Okay,
So you have to listen to that. I'll tell you a quick Cameron story, and everyone, please, again, we are now, you guys can leave. It's now just between us. We're just talking now because we're geeks. Russell Carpenter gets called into his Malibu house, and he's like, "We're going to do True Lies." It was about True Lies because he did True Lies and then he did Titanic, and now he's doing all the Avatars. And he calls him up, and James Cameron just brings him into his mansion in Malibu, and they're walking around, and he's just talking to Russell like he got the job. Like, there's no offer, there's no nothing. He's just talking to him like he's been hired. So he gets out, he leaves, he's like, I think I was hired? And then, and Cameron during that time, even during the Titanic time, his reputation is, he's rough. Let's just call, he's rough, he's a little bit of a taskmaster, let's call it. Cameron's legendary for being that dude on set. And so then he's shooting True Lies, and everyone's like, how's it working with James Cameron? And he's like, it's great. I have no problem. I don't understand why everyone's having such an issue with James. They're like, we've been shooting for a couple days. It's been peaches. It's been great. So they're in his Malibu house again, his screening room in Malibu, and they're seeing dailies. And a shot comes up from Arnold, and then guys, everyone prepare yourselves. I'm going to curse. I don't curse very often. I'm just quoting Mr. Cameron at this point. And he goes, what the fuck is that? And Russell was like, he starts like digging it. And the production designer's there, and the first AD is there, and a couple of their keys are there. And he goes, hey, Russell, I just spent $20 million on the biggest movie star on Earth. It'd be nice if I could see his fucking face.
Oh, no.
Wow. And then
all of a sudden, the next shot comes up, and he just goes to town at every single shot. And Russell's just like, oh, God. So he leaves. He's out in the parking area, and he's like, he's calling his wife. He's like, I've been fired. There's no way I can go back. I mean, obviously James Cameron wants to get rid of me. Then the production designer and the first AD come out, and he goes, Russell, he does that to everybody. He goes, what are you doing? He goes, no, that's, he called all the other DPs he's worked with. He does it to everybody. He calls up the DP from the abyss, and he goes, did he try the whole, I want to see the face guy? Yeah, he does it to me too. He does it to everybody. It's not you. Wow. You're fine. Just keep going. And that is James Cameron.
We saw recently.
That's amazing.
We saw the some of the behind the scenes from The Abyss as well.
I was about to say that. Did you see that documentary?
Have you seen the set? Like the underwater?
No, but did you see the documentary? You've seen the whole documentary, right? The whole like.
Yeah, it's just like, what am I looking at? I mean, all the way from the beginning, right, Cameron? You go, oh, yeah, the guy that made Avatar. You go, No.
Let's
see how they make The Abyss. Like, a nuclear silo. Let's fill it with water and build our set. What are you talking about?
He's been, I'll give you one more Cameron story, and then we will end this interview. Because we could just keep talking for another hour. I read in one of Cameron's biographies on The Abyss, if you saw the behind the scenes of The Abyss, and by the way, anyone listening here should go watch The Abyss if you haven't seen it, and get the DVD and or Blu-ray and watch arguably one of the best filmmaking documentaries I've ever seen, up there with Hearts of Darkness for Apocalypse Now. It is amazing to watch. You just sit there with your mouth on the floor the entire time they're doing it. And the suits at 20th Century Fox, it was way over budget. It was like $50 million, $60 million to make the movie. And it was just going up and up. And like, you know, the tarp broke and the filtration system broke. And they had to buy these really expensive, design these really expensive suits so people could not only see, and we could see their faces. So he has so on the line item, it's wardrobe. It's wardrobe, but it costs like $10,000. And everyone, like no one knows what's going on at the studio, they're somewhere in North Carolina. So a suit flies in. And if you saw the behind the scenes, Cameron, you know, you're underwater 10 hours, so you have to decompress for 2 or 3 hours underwater so you can come up without getting the bends. And Cameron was doing this all day, every day. He was in the water more than anybody else. So he was a taskmaster, but he was proving, he's walking the walk. So he's just getting out of this decomposition. He takes off that helmet that they built, right? And this guy comes up who's obviously a suit, an executive, he comes up and goes, hey, James, I'm here from the... And before he could finish the sentence, James took the helmet and slammed it on the guy's head. So now the guy can't breathe because it's without oxygen, that thing is airtight. So now he can't breathe. He grabs him by the by his tie and lifts him over like he's dangling from the edge. And if he falls into water, the dude is going to die. If he falls into water, unless someone gets to him, he's going to die. And he dangles him there while the guy's like barely breathing for like 10 seconds. Then he pulls him back in, rips the thing off. He goes, if I ever see you on my fucking scent again, I'll kill you. And now you see, this is the 90s, guys. This is early 90s. This is a whole other world. I don't suggest you do something like this, but these are the legendary stories of James Cameron. This is one of a billion of them that I have heard or read about over the years. And I know a lot of people who've worked with him. And every single time I meet with somebody, like I had another guy. Okay, one more story. And that'll be the last James Cameron story. A buddy of mine, he was at the DGA, and he's a DGA director, and he's, you know, he's a good director in his own right, and has a couple films under his belt, and he's big in music videos at the time. And I think it was Spielberg and Cameron, I think in Jackson or someone like that, were there giving a talk to the other, and they're like, yeah, you need to do this, and we're doing this is the new way, and do all this. And my buddy comes up, he stands up, he goes, hey, James, that's really nice because you're James Cameron.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
I don't have access to that kind of stuff. Like, in front of everybody, called out James Cameron, in front of all these other directors. And James goes, well, what are you doing tomorrow? Do you want to come to set? Now, this is Avatar before anybody knew what the hell Avatar was. Before anyone knew what the technology, all you heard was rumors about what the technology was that was being built. And I even heard, I was here at that time, I was here in LA. So I heard like through the grapevine, like James Cameron's doing something like this. So he shows up onto set, which is the volume, right? And he's, yeah, the volume. And there's this, and they're basically developing technology. This is all brand new technology they're developing. So behind them in this soundstage, there's like three rows up with just computers. It must have been 40 people with wires and computer gears and just servers and shit, just because, you know. And you see James Cameron with this monitor in front of him. And in the monitor, wherever he moves the camera, you see Avatar. You see I forgot the name of the planet, Pandora. Yeah, you see Pandora, right? So you see Pandora in real time. In real time. You're seeing everything in real time. So he sees everything, but it's all virtual. So then my buddy's standing behind him because he's shadowing him. He stands behind and he's watching and he goes, all right, action. And it's the scene where they arrive the first time, the helicopter, and they jump out.
Oh, yeah.
That thing, right? So he does, and he goes in the tank, goes, action. And he jumps off like a stool. He jumps off with the camera and he runs into a digital tree. Like he runs into a digital tree. And he goes, hey, Jimmy, can you move this thing about 20 feet that way? And he goes, sure, James. And all of a sudden, like from God, a mouse from God comes into the screen, clicks on this tree in real time, lifts it up, roots and all, moves it over 30 feet and plants it over there. Let's go again.
Whoa.
And he's like, and then they do, so then my buddy comes up to him after like, you know, a few hours of this, and they're like prepping something. And he goes, James, man, this is pretty cool technology, man. And this is where you understand where James Cameron's in a completely different playing field than any of us are. He goes, you know what would be really fucking cool? If I didn't have a cable to this damn thing. This cable has been driving me nuts. I wish we could figure out a way to do this without a cable. It's the most cutting edge technology in film history at the moment. And he's like, but the cable is bugging me.
It's not perfect yet.
And
well,
that,
we need people like that though, right?
And that is... And that is James Cameron. I'm sorry, everyone, for listening. If you're still with us, we turned this into a James Cameron love fest. I apologize.
What's wrong with that?
But guys, where can people find you, what you're doing, your film, all that good stuff?
Well, we have a website, cosmosmovieofficial.com, where you can find out where you can check out the film and follow us on social media and even buy some merchandise if you fancy.
Some merch, sir. You're selling merch. Nice.
We're selling caps and they're flying off the shelf. but yeah, we're on all social media and we make it our personal quest to reply to every single piece of correspondence we get. So if you have any questions about the process or about your own movie and how distribution might work or this, that, and the other,
just get in touch. We're always happy to talk genuinely.
Thank you guys for being an inspiration to the film tribe and to filmmakers everywhere. We need stories like this to keep us going because it is a fairly depressing time that we're in currently. And before the situation that we're all in, it was still depressing. 2019, it was still fairly depressing for filmmakers, especially independent filmmakers, and making money and making your movies and all this kind of stuff. So these are the kind of stories I like to promote and really give people inspiration to go out there and make their movies. And you guys are the personification of Indie Film Hustle. So thank you guys so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having us. It's honestly, it's awesome to be on the show.
We've had a blast. Thank you.
I want to thank Xander and Elliot so much for coming on the show and inspiring the Indie Film Hustle tribe with their misadventures in making Cosmos. Thank you so, so much, guys. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/442. And if you haven't seen Cosmos, I highly recommend you check it out. Links in the show notes. And of course, if you want to check out another film shot on the Blackmagic pocket camera, of course, you could check out my film On the Corner of Ego and Desire, shot at the Sundance Film Festival. And you can check that out at egoanddesirefilm.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.